This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today we talk with an imam about anti-Muslim protests in Michigan.
Most of the people don't even understand the basics of the religion of Islam.
That doesn't seem to stop them from hating it, though. We talk with the Grand Rapids Police Chief about improving relations with the community.
That's our goal, to make sure that everyone feels that they're treated equitably, that they're treated fairly, that we've got both the transparency and the accountability that this community deserves.
We talk with Senator Gary Peters about the future of the environment of the Great Lakes and a choke point for shipping on the lakes.
If you don't have that raw material coming through, you can't make steel. And if you can't make steel, you don't make cars, you don't make appliances, and just go on down the list.
Plus, an artisan of Michigan who ties flies for fly fishing.
Virtually any fur, any hair, any feather can and probably has been used in fly tying.
But first, let's get a news update. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, a conversation with U.S. Senator Gary Peters, from border security to his thoughts on the latest in Washington, plus shipping on the Great Lakes.
It has been categorized by many people as the Achilles heel of manufacturing in North America, because if you don't have that raw material coming through, you can't make steel. And if you can't make steel, you don't make cars, you don't make appliances, and just go on down the list.
But first, one of the men behind the attacks in London on Saturday had closely followed the teachings of a radical American preacher, according to one of his friends. That preacher is from Dearborn, where the BBC's Alim Maqbool tried to catch up with him.
To please the enemies of Allah and the enemies of mankind.
Ahmed Musa Jibreel, an American, but one of the most popular online voices among Brits who go to fight with so-called Islamic State.
I'm telling you facts.
He calls for jihad and preaches separation of Muslims from non-Muslims or kuffar.
Hours ago, masses of the Ummah were joining with the kuffar in their New Year's celebration.
A former friend of London attacker, Khurram Butt, says it was Jibreel's videos that helped radicalize him. The preacher himself is a free man living in Michigan. Well, we've been trying to speak with Ahmed Musa Jibreel about his preaching, but for now at least, he's a pretty hard man to track down. His neighbours, though, have told us they thought he was nice and friendly and said they had no idea he'd produce such videos.
If you look at a group like ISIS, they use Jibreel to radicalise individuals.
But the FBI knew. As head of the agency in Michigan, Andrew Arena tried for years to stop Jibreel spreading his hate, but never managed to find that the preacher had actually broken the law as such.
He's very smart, you know, as many of these folks are. They know there's a line that they can go up to and not to cross that line.
But talking generally about killing people, making Jews orphans, that's not enough.
Unfortunately, in this country, it's not.
Ahmed Musa Jibreel has been a nuisance to Muslims in this area, too. Just ask the imam of the American Islamic Center, Muhammad Redwan Mardini.
He will come and say things to imams sometimes that, you know, you are, you know, out, separated from your religion. This is not the way, that you are just bluffing.
Imam Mardini is among those who've called for action against Jibreel.
Freedom of speech stop as a speech. But when you have someone act upon that, this is crossing the line. That should not be.
Do you think there are others, even in this community, who are coming close to that line?
There's many of them. Many of them. You watch, the internet is full of them.
Here, stopping those who aren't quite caught crossing from preaching hate to actively supporting militants is tough, even if they potentially inspire violent acts. But that's not just a problem for this community, and certainly not just an issue for the U.S.
That's the BBC's Alim Maqbool. Tomorrow in Lansing, there will be an anti-Islam protest called the March Against Sharia. It's one of a couple dozen protests across the nation. There has not been a lot of media coverage about the march. What we have seen has been in the Metro Times. Here now is Imam Sohail Chaudhry of the Islamic Society of Greater Lansing. Thanks for joining us. These anti-Islam protesters point to the atrocities of the Islamic State, or ISIS. They point to that Dearborn cleric, Ahmed Musa Jibreel, whose YouTube videos might have inspired one of the attackers in London. They also note that the U.S. has been fighting Islamic extremists for more than a decade, and they see the followers of Islam as threats, as the enemy. What are they missing?
Well, the first thing that people need to know is that, you know, most of the people don't even understand the basics of the religion of Islam. There's a lot of ignorance in the country, and groups like these, they play on that ignorance. There is a $55 million Islamophobia industry within the United States, and they spread fears and lies and misconceptions about Islam and the Muslims. And then on the other side, you have the ISIS or these extremist organizations working within the Muslim world. And the problem is that neither of them represent the Islamic community or the Muslim community. We have over 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. ISIS does not represent us, and these Islamophobes do not represent us. So we have no representation, and this is one of the biggest problems that we're facing.
How are you responding? How are you and your fellow Muslims responding to this march against Sharia?
Well, you know, we are not reacting to any of these marches or these protests which are going on, because they have been going on for a very long time. What we are concentrating on is educating the general public, trying to tackle the issue of ignorance by inviting people to our center, by interacting with the churches and synagogues around us, by educating the masses on what Sharia really is. I mean, these people are saying that Sharia is coming to the United States, so, you know, oh, people, be afraid of these Muslims and be afraid of Islam. I mean, I would personally encourage anyone who wants to know what Sharia is to go to Washington, D.C., to the United States Supreme Court building, and on the north wall of the Supreme Court building, you'll find an image or a frieze of a man holding the Quran as an inspiration for the law of the United States. Sharia came to the U.S. 240 years ago when the founding fathers were drafting the Constitution and, you know, making the laws for this country. Do these people know that the right of education for people is Sharia law, that women can vote in Islam is Sharia law, that taking care of the environment is Sharia law? To be pure and to pray five times a day is Sharia law. I mean, what are they talking about when they say there shouldn't be any Sharia law in this country?
I think the fear is, and I'm not speaking on behalf of them, certainly, I think the fear is that they're going to be subject to Sharia law, and it seems foreign to them. How are the members of the Society of Greater Lansing, the Muslims in the Lansing area, how are they feeling about this demonstration?
Well, for the good thing is most of the people are not even aware of this protest going on. And, you know, most people are just ignoring these people. We are trying to spread the message of nonviolence and peace amongst our members. We're telling people to avoid this rally and avoid going to the area where they're holding this protest. As I said, we're concentrating on education. We have an Islam 101 session, which is planned the first Sunday of every month at the Islamic Center. We just had a session this Sunday on what Sharia really means and how it has contributed to the American system. Really, you know, my message to the people out there, if you really want to know who the Muslims are and what Islam is all about, reach out to your local center. You know, go in and have a visit. See what the Muslims are doing in these centers. We're praying five times a day. We're giving charity. We're, you know, doctors and engineers and physicians and instructors at different facilities. We're contributing to the American society, and that's what Sharia teaches us to do. That's what Islam teaches us to do.
An organization called Wash Away the Hate in Michigan plans a counter demonstration to the anti-Islamic demonstration. You've been asked to join that counter demonstration, and I understand you're reluctant and you're discouraging, as you mentioned, you're discouraging Muslims from participating. Why?
I mean, we're not discouraging anyone from participating, but we feel that, you know, giving too much attention to these rallies just serves their purpose. That's what they're seeking. They're looking for media attention. They're looking for counter protests. They want to interact and engage with us on that front, and we shouldn't give them the opportunity because that just plays into their hands.
This is only the latest in a number of these Islamophobic gatherings. There have been some in Dearborn and other places across the nation. What does the frequency of these kinds of events tell you?
Well, what it tells us is that, you know, the Islamophobia industry is active and it is resourceful and they are working hard. And so we, on the other side, people who love peace and people who want this country to thrive and grow in the right direction, we need to work hard as well. We need to, you know, form relationships with each other. We need to get to know each other better. We need to educate ourselves about each other. They are active and we need to be active too.
This is the month of Ramadan, and there's a greeting, Ramadan Kareem. Can you tell us what that means?
That means the glorious Ramadan or the generous Ramadan is upon us. So, you know, we greet each other when Ramadan comes because Ramadan is a month of peace. Ramadan is a month where we spiritually grow and we connect ourselves to God Almighty, our creator and sustainer.
Is it not also a month that you go out of your way to do charitable acts?
Yes, that is correct. There are statements of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, you know, in which he said that that charity in Ramadan is multiplied many fold. So a lot of Muslims around the world, and even here in the U.S., they keep their charities for the month of Ramadan, and they become very, very generous.
If you could reason with these protesters, what would you tell them when they have these deeply held beliefs about Islam and Sharia law?
What we would tell them is, as I said earlier, to reach out and come in. You know, our centers are open. We pray five times a day, and most of the centers around the U.S., you know, hold sessions on Islam, on educating people, spreading awareness. We are actively involved in blood drives. We are actively involved in food drives in our communities. Come and see what we really are about rather than just, you know, assuming things, you know, based on what the media is teaching the people or based on these lies and fabrications which ISIS and groups like them have invented about Islam.
Imam Suhail Chaudhry is with the Islamic Society of Greater Lansing. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Still to come, the Grand Rapids Police Chief joins us to talk about community and police relations.
What we're looking to do is add additional resources to make sure we have the capacity to both be responsive to crime and still work to build relationships built on trust.
Plus, we'll have an Artisans of Michigan report for you on tying flies for fly fishing. That's in 15 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Let's catch up on a couple of things that happened in Lansing this week. Joining us, as they do most Fridays, are, via Skype, Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate, and Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Yesterday, the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services issued a news release about a federal court update. It stated something like, Michigan continues significant progress in better protecting children in its child welfare system. Then an advocacy group talking about that same court update says Michigan has a long way to go before it can guarantee the safety and welfare of children in foster care. Ken, what do you make of those two very different perspectives?
The advocacy group Children's Rights is the group that originally sued the state some years ago for failing to adequately protect children. And a federal judge has jurisdiction over that case. The federal judge has appointed an independent evaluator to answer to the federal judge and really have an opinion as to whether or not the state is meeting its obligation to protect children. So there's a lot of what I would call independent and judicial oversight over it. And it's really the judge and I think the independent monitor that is supposed to sort out the claims and the counterclaims, ultimately, though, to get to the point of adequately protecting children that are in the foster care system.
Vicki, the group that Ken mentioned, they filed that lawsuit more than a decade ago, and it says this report finds the state is not doing background checks on many relatives who take in foster kids and not investigating credible allegations of abuse or neglect. That sounds pretty serious.
It is very serious. But I want to point out we have come a long way in the last decade in terms of dealing with the foster care system and protecting children. But we still have a long way to go. There are allegations that the caseload is still too high, that cases are being assigned to workers who are on extended leave, and so a lot of children are slipping through the cracks. That's just not acceptable, and we need to fix that.
Let's move on. This week, a House committee passed a couple of bills that would ban so-called sanctuary cities by requesting local police, or requiring, rather, local police to enforce federal immigration laws. Ken, a lot of opponents showed up to that hearing, so many that they spilled into an overflow room. No one testified in favor of the bills. Still passed. Mostly opponents say local law enforcement officials are not trained to do immigration work and a mistake could violate constitutional protections. What do you think of banning sanctuary cities?
Well, the issue of immigration, whether it's immigration law, policy, or enforcement, is really a federal matter. So I think one of the basic questions is, you know, why should the state have any role in this at all? And if the state wants to enact a law, it invites just a lot of questions that have to get sorted out. There's plenty of occasion in the past where legislators want to express their opinion about federal policy. You know, Republicans are going to want to support a Republican president and vice versa. But I think there are kind of better ways to do it than passing a law. You could pass a resolution, for example, because that's a way to express your opinion about federal policy without getting into the problematic areas of passing a law that has, you know, state legal implications.
Vicky, in an opinion piece, State Representative Stephanie Chang, a Democrat, wrote in the Free Press, these bills jeopardize public safety because immigrant community members will be more afraid to report a crime for fear of being detained or taken away by the police. What do you think of that argument?
She's absolutely correct. There needs to be cooperation and trust in a community for citizens to report crimes and to reach out to their public safety professionals. And many communities spend a lot of time working with their police officers and public safety departments to foster that kind of community policing system where people feel comfortable when they see a police officer on the street. And this law also has a very insidious portion in it. And I mention that because what it does is there's another section that would allow any citizen in a community to file suit against their elected officials should they believe that the city is not complying or the village or community or county is not complying with this particular law. And that would invite a bunch of disgruntled citizens to suddenly start filing lawsuits against their city officials and tying them up in court. Certainly, there are more important things that we need to be dealing with.
That's Vicky Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. And we heard from Ken Sycamore with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislator. Thanks to both of you. Have a nice weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Lester.
The city of Grand Rapids has been working on trying to find ways to make sure the police officers are not treating citizens unequally and improving relations with the community. Grand Rapids Police Chief David Rahinsky joins us now to talk about that. So the city has been working on implementing this so-called 12-point plan, something that's been in the works for a couple of years. But a recent traffic stop report indicated your officers are treating people of color differently than white citizens. And then there was the recent incident with an officer pulling his weapon on five unarmed African-American boys. So where is the city and the police department in implementing this 12-point plan?
Well, the 12-point plan, I think, has served both the department and the city well in response to the two specific incidents that you've mentioned. What the traffic stop study showed is that minorities were stopped at a disproportionately higher rate than the motoring public that they consist of. So that's an issue that we're looking deeper in to try to identify why that's the case. In terms of the incident that happened back in March, we had specific information from a resident who called and said he had seen youths fitting that description carrying a handgun, passing a revolver back and forth. So while it was difficult to watch any time an officer points a gun at young people and orders them to the ground, what the officer was doing was acting on specific articulated information. Ultimately, we had a chance to meet with the parents and explain our actions, and those are conversations that are ongoing now.
Some concerned citizens have been giving you poor grades for the 12-point plan implementation. The city says much of it's complete. The citizens say you're not really complete. You've got work to do. You might have started the process, but it is a process. So they gave you a D. What grade would you give the effort?
Well, I think it's important. That was one small group that consists of a particular segment of the community that we've been working very hard to make inroads with. So I say that to say that I attend community meetings, the service area captains, the community police specialists attend meetings citywide. So it's a city of 200,000 people, 300 plus police officers. The group that met, I think, consisted of about 70 people. The meeting took place on the same night of a commission meeting. So unfortunately, they didn't get what I would think of as a good cross-section of representatives. And I say that to say this. when I attend community meetings throughout the city, inevitably I hear of the good works that the men and women of this department are doing, whether it's the presence we have at the Boys and Girls Club, volunteering at Camp O'Malley for the summer, whether it's our program to teach inner city children how to play baseball, whether it's the Youth Police Academy that we run, the Police Explorers Program, the Citizens Police Academy. So there's a lot that this department does that the community appreciates, and our officers hear that all the time.
It might be a small group, but that's the whole point, is it? So I'd like to ask that question again. What grade would you give your effort and why?
I would give us a B+. And by that, I mean this is not a one and done. When I look at things that we have to do, like the training component of the 12-point plan is something that is ongoing. But when I look at the plan, everything from implementing body-worn cameras to undergoing bias-based training, which I've now been through two sessions of, to implementing a technology policy with the input of the ACLU and other stakeholders, those have all been completed. Outsourcing police involved in the shootings, which has been completed. 11 of the 12, including the traffic study, have been completed. The only one that remains to be done is to take a look at the arrest disparity that exists and try to identify causational factors.
Let me question a little bit on a couple of those.
Sure.
I was in Ferguson, Missouri last year. The police academy in the area was struggling with coming to grips with implicit bias, the concept that many white people hold unconscious biases and they need to become aware of them and work to deal with them, or they'll never actually be able to protect and serve all of their citizens. And that's not easy. One course doesn't usually do it. It takes a lot of training. How are you going to be approaching that? I mean, is that one seminar going to be it?
No, it's ongoing. So we've undergone two sessions in the last year. It's now something that we put our new hires through. It's also something that we've incorporated into our in-service training. So it'll be ongoing. But to your point, it's particularly important that we be aware of those biases and that we don't let them affect our judgment. So while I think it's correct to say that it would be very difficult to eradicate any of those biases because they're cultural, they're historic, they're systemic, they're not unique to police work, but they're broad spread throughout our culture. So from a law enforcement standpoint, what I think we're trying to accomplish is be aware of them and make sure that they don't affect your actions.
Let's talk about community policing a bit, because that means more than just cruising around through the neighborhood and waving. I mean, it means real interaction. It means officers changing their behaviors. How's that working?
The challenge that we have right now is capacity. At one time, we had 400 officers in the department. Now we've got 292. So we'll handle about 400 calls for service in a 24-hour period with about 40-some officers on the street. So by standard metrics, crime rate and clearance rate, this agency has done remarkably well. But as the metrics for success have changed to include community engagement, which is very labor-intensive, we want, and the officers want, and the community want, to see the officers in the parks, in the schools, talking to kids, walking the neighborhood. So what we're looking to do is add additional resources to make sure we have the capacity to both be responsive to crime and still work to build relationships built on trust.
The reports I've seen, some citizens say, the last thing we need is more cops. What's your response to that statement?
And I can understand that perspective if what they're envisioning is people who are out there with just a strict enforcement perspective. What we're asking for is additional personnel to go out and do the good works that we see police officers doing in our community. I wouldn't disagree from the perspective that we don't need necessarily more police officers in the traditional enforcement role. What we need is more officers who can get out from behind the car, get out of this building, get out on the streets, get out in the neighborhoods, in the parks, and in the playgrounds.
Let's bottom line this. I mean, basically, the residents of Grand Rapids want to be treated equally, be able to trust the department is not targeting people of color. They want to know the neighborhood patrol officers, like we've been talking about. They want to know the workings of the police department by making it more transparent. So how are you going to be able to accomplish that to the point that the citizens you serve are satisfied?
Well, it's a big undertaking, and I think what you do is you go about it in small bites day by day. You know, these relationships, some of the negative perceptions regarding law enforcement that have historical roots in things that have been happening for generations are not going to be changed with one interaction with a police officer. Me having open office hours or a captain sitting down with someone over a cup of coffee, it's going to take more than that. It's going to take a sustained effort. I'm a resident of the city as well. I take a lot of pride in the department, and I want this city to feel as safe, in any neighborhood as I feel in mine. So that's our goal, to make sure that everyone feels that they're treated equitably, that they're treated fairly, that we've got both the transparency and the accountability that this community deserves.
David Rohensky is the Grand Rapids Police Chief. Chief, thanks for talking with us.
All right, sir. Thank you. Take care.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Let's take a trip to Grand Rapids for the next visit with an artisan of Michigan. We're at the home of Dennis Potter, who's doing what he discovered he loved in 1977, tying flies for fly fishing.
Gotta get my, hang on, my God, I gotta get my fly tying glasses on. Oh. I got computer glasses, fly tying glasses, regular glasses, and of course these are filthy.
Potter says he remembers tying his first fly and then going fishing with it.
To take that fly that I tied, I can show you within 6 inches on a log where I caught my first trout on the Osawa River almost 40 years ago.
Dennis Potter was hooked. Get it? He took a fly tying class, but he says his real education came from being fortunate enough to know a lot of good fly tiers. He studied not just the flies of others, but he studied insects. He loved learning the Latin names of the insects the fish preyed on.
Trout, in particular, can become very selective, not only to a specific species of insect that they're feeding on, but a certain stage of the life cycle of that insect. So if you don't have the right bug, it can be difficult.
Potter seems to be living pretty well. He's got a nice house in Grand Rapids. He has a place on the Osawa River. So I had to ask, how did he manage to get to the point where he could make a living tying flies? He scoffed. He told me he's not. He was lucky enough to leave the family business, trade places with his wife, Karen, became what he calls the house husband, and tie flies.
There are very, very few people who make a living, quote unquote, being commercial fly tiers. It's an unbelievable commitment, and you virtually have to tie every day.
He says even then you'd be lucky to pull in about $20,000 a year. But Potter's done okay. He designs patterns for a company called Umqua Feather Merchants. His flies are duplicated in factories in Sri Lanka, Thailand, and other places. He gets a small commission from that. He makes more money from his own retail operation, Riverhouse Fly Company. And he speaks at shows and workshops and produces instructional videos and so on.
I absolutely love the teaching aspect of this. And it sounds corny. I'm driven to share all this information that I've borrowed, stolen from others, come up with on my own. By far, the greatest satisfaction that I get is helping somebody get better at what they're doing.
The entire time we talked, Potter was tying flies. He'd grab a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and in 2 minutes, actually less than 2 minutes, he tied a fly. There were all kinds of materials around him.
The natural materials, deer hair, elk hair, calf tails, peacock, turkey feathers. Virtually any fur, any hair, any feather can and probably has been used in fly tying.
He points at a fly he's been working on while we talked.
Many, many years ago, off that fly would have been deer hair or elk hair. But it gets wet, it breaks, it gets heavy. So anything that I can do with synthetic as opposed to hair, I'm going to do.
Synthetic materials are lighter. They just don't soak up water, so they stay on the surface of the water better, just like many insects do. And some of them are shiny, just like some bugs. His favorite material to use is opal tinsel. Like a lot of artisans I've met, Potter takes pride in his work, and he believes he stands out because he puts in more effort than some of his competitors.
Every fly that I tie for a fly shop or my retail customers is tied exactly the same way as the flies that go on my fly box. And that's not the case with a lot of commercial tires. They'll crank out something quick that doesn't have the durability. They don't all look the same. I just simply refuse to do that. So could I tie faster? Yes, absolutely, but I don't.
Do you have to think like a fish?
You have to think like a fish? Not when you're tying. Well, yeah, I guess you do, I've tied enough that when I do come up with something new, I can look at it and go, wow, that's going to catch fish. You simply know.
And it only took tying a few hundred thousand flies to get there. That's Dennis Potter with Riverhouse Fly Company, our latest artisan of Michigan. That guy was a lot of fun to be with. Coming up, a conversation with Senator Gary Peters. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Every once in a while, we get a chance to sit down with an elected official for a while and get an update on what's important to them and to Michigan. And today, that official is U.S. Senator Gary Peters. Thanks for coming in.
Well, it's great to be with you, Lester.
I definitely want to talk to you about FBI Director James Comey's testimony and President Trump's tweets, but let's do that a little later. Let's get to some legislation you're sponsoring. And one is construction of a larger lock at the series of locks at Sault Ste. Marie. There are four locks making up the Sault locks. Everybody talks about the Sault locks as if we're supposed to know why they're important. So what do locks do?
Well, locks allow ships to go across areas that there's a change in elevation. So whenever there's a change in elevation, there's usually waterfalls or rapids. Obviously, a ship can't go through waterfalls and rapids, so they go through a series of locks to change elevation. And that's what happens at the Sault locks, which connects Lake Superior with the rest of the Great Lakes system. It is a critical place, given the fact that we get an awful lot of iron ore and other raw materials for steel production and other types of basic manufacturing that comes from both the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, but also from northern Minnesota. And
right,
the
I've been to the taconite mines in Minnesota, and I don't know if everybody knows what taconite is. It's a low-grade iron ore, but it's critical to a lot of manufacturing and steel mills throughout the Great Lakes region. So we've got this one big lock. It's called the Poe Lock, and it lets bigger cargo ships go through. What size are we talking about here?
Well, it's the large ones, the 1,000-footers. So these are very large ships. They're it's the only lock that can accommodate these 1,000-foot freighters, which is the bulk of the fleet. So that means about 80% of all of the material that goes through the Sault locks goes through just that one lock. And to put it in perspective of how much material it is, one ship is the equivalent of probably over 3,000 big trucks of material there, or hundreds of rail cars. So it's a very efficient way to move material, all loaded on these very large ships.
So one of these locks of the four can handle those ships. Why do we need another one?
Well, it's old. It needs maintenance and extensive maintenance. And because it's old, should it fail in a catastrophic way, now you've suddenly shut down the movement of material. As I mentioned, over 80% of all the material that comes down from the iron mines, for example. It has been categorized by many people as the Achilles heel of manufacturing in North America, because if you don't have that raw material coming through, you can't make steel. And if you can't make steel, you don't make cars, you don't make appliances, and just go on down the list. In fact, the Department of Homeland Security has done a study, and they show that if there is a 30-60-day shutdown of that lock, the entire economy would actually go into a recession. In fact, they're talking about
the whole U.S. economy.
The whole U.S. economy. And that's why you have this Achilles heel. You lose, they're claiming, we could lose over 10 million jobs in the United States.
Well, let me play devil's advocate with that, because you've got rail cars. They could bring that iron ore down. You've got an import corridor in the Great Lakes. You could bring in Brazilian steel, and I know we do that. We ship that in. So why would it shut down the U.S. economy or cause a recession?
Well, it's and actually that is the important part of this study that was a flaw in previous studies, because there isn't really alternatives to move it. Let's say the 3,000 truck example, not just one ship. We don't have an extra 3,000 trucks just sitting around waiting to move iron ore.
Or rail cars.
Or rail cars, or for that matter, truck drivers. There's a shortage of truck drivers already. But even more significant, now, so you don't even really have the ability to move it, but then when it gets to the steel mill, steel mills are designed to take that material from a ship and put it into the system. If a truck shows up with it, there are no systems to actually take it off a truck and put it in. There are all of the conveyor belts, all of the machinery is designed for shipborne. Now, you could build it, but you can't build it overnight. Then you'd have to build a whole new infrastructure. So, you know, the system is all very efficiently designed to take cargo off of a big ship coming in and offloading in mills both in Michigan, in Ohio, down the Chicago area.
I want to talk about this day, everybody's talking about privatizing public assets. You know, trucking firms have to pay taxes on fuel and permits and licenses to drive on the roads. These ships don't pay anything toward the cost of infrastructure such as locks. Why should the government use taxpayer dollars to pay for this?
Well, they do pay. I mean, they pay into a larger fund that deals with dredging. It deals with locks. It's all part of a large government fund that supports all of that. So they do pay into that system.
In what way? What's charged? How are they taxed?
It's based on, I believe it's based on the amount of cargo. So the more cargo they carry, it's a charge based on the amount of material that they take. Bigger ships will pay more than smaller ships.
Fair enough. All right. While we're on the subject of the Great Lakes, let's talk about President Trump's proposed budget. The Great Lakes region dodged a bullet because it looked as though the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative would be cut to the bone right away this year. It wasn't for this fiscal year. But the Trump administration budget for next year calls for the complete elimination of the Restoration Initiative and cuts to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We'll talk about that in a second. First, tell us why the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is important.
Well, it's absolutely critical to maintain the quality that we have in the Great Lakes. And we have to remember, you know, step back as to why I think it's so outrageous to see this cut in the restoration fund. And something that has always received bipartisan support. This is something that folks in Congress understand is important. And if you think of the Great Lakes as a source of drinking water, over 40 million Americans drink water out of the Great Lakes. That's an incredible source of drinking water. To think that you wouldn't be working to constantly keep it clean and to make it cleaner, and to think that we have, you talked about shipping, we've had commerce in the Great Lakes for many, many years, well before there were environmental regulations. We have toxic hotspots as a result of activities that have occurred over the years. Some of these hotspots continue to leach out into the lakes. Restoration funding is about cleaning that up, making sure that the water is not contaminated. It stays clean not only for current use but for future generations, not to mention all the recreational use, the fishing. It is an incredible economic asset for the entire country, which is why this restoration funding is so important.
Of the eight Great Lakes states, Michigan is by far the biggest beneficiary of money from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. It goes to the research, as you were talking about, restoring wetlands, cleanup, fighting the spread of invasive species, also really important. This work is done by both private entities and public entities and universities. How much money overall in a year is spent on those activities across the Great Lakes region?
Well, it's over $300 million has been spent on that, has been the appropriations. It should be more. So the fact that you actually zero it out is wrong. We have been able, as you mentioned in the, at the beginning, as we were able to keep that funding in the most recent budget. But now we're back at it here again in September when that funding comes to an end. This is not something that we should be fighting for every single year. This has in the past received bipartisan support. And just in terms of the amount of money relative to the federal budget, it is incredibly a small amount. And yet it has a huge, huge impact on probably the most important freshwater source in the world.
Let's talk about NOAA. It's got a Great Lakes Research Lab here in Ann Arbor. Why is that important?
Well, NOAA is Oceanic Administration. It's about weather forecasting. It's about water quality. It's about marine sanctuaries. They have a wide range of missions. But if we just look at the cuts to NOAA in their weather forecasting, which is, I think, perhaps behind what is behind some of the Trump administration cuts, is that they're not big fans of facts or science, particularly if it comes to climate change. But NOAA monitors weather. It studies climate. It gives us information about what the future holds. And that's just so important for everyday business, for agriculture, to be able to forecast droughts, where floods may occur. Weather forecasting is about the economy on a day-to-day basis. And these cuts will seriously impair their ability to do that. In addition to research in the Great Lakes, the marine sanctuary, we have a very successful marine sanctuary up in the Alpena area, which has been a huge economic driver for northern Michigan and an incredible way to protect a large expanse of Lake Huron. These cuts would once again be very devastating to the Great Lakes, and particularly when you're looking at algal blooms that we saw in Lake Erie that had a very serious negative impact on drinking water for communities downriver as well as in northern Ohio.
Right. Toledo had a huge shutdown. Yeah.
And it's NOAA that gives us the information to handle those crises.
But Senator Peters, President Trump says he needs this money to build a wall along the Mexico-U.S. border to keep us safe. Now, which is more important, keeping us safe from illegal immigrants or keeping the water safe to drink, the fish populations healthy, the commerce through the Great Lakes shipping? I mean, come on.
Well, let me say first off, we do have to have secure borders. There's no question that our borders have to be secure. You maintain your sovereignty, but you also have to ask the question, how do you do that efficiently? Building a wall, folks who are in this profession for a living from Homeland Security tell you that a wall is not the answer. It is a lot more complex. In fact, it's curious that we have cuts in organizations like the United States Coast Guard, which will also impact us here in Michigan, but cuts to the Coast Guard in order to pay for a wall. And I have to remind the Trump administration, we have more water borders than we do land borders. If you cut the Coast Guard, that's part of Homeland Security. It's part of border protection. We have to be much more thoughtful about it. It makes, I guess, a good campaign slogan. You can get applause line at a rally, but it's not the most efficient way to keep our borders safe, which we do have to do, but we can be more thoughtful about it.
Let's talk about pipelines. After the largest inland oil spill in the nation's history caused by a ruptured Enbridge pipeline near the Kalamazoo River, people in Michigan are concerned about oil and gas pipelines. A lot of concerns about Enbridge Line 5, which goes under the Straits of Mackinac. If that were to break or rupture, the scenario does not look good for the Great Lakes. Even with the least severe computer models, it looks bad. But the most severe predict shorelines of Lake Huron and Lake Michigan would be oil-soaked. That's something that goes beyond party positions. Republicans and Democrats alike are concerned about it. Elected officials in both parties want Line 5 shut down. What can Congress do?
Well, there's a variety of things we can do, and I agree our long-term goal needs to be to shut down this pipeline. And you mentioned the potential catastrophic impact of it. In fact, a University of Michigan study was very clear. It said that the absolute worst place to have a pipeline break anywhere in the entire Great Lakes Basin is the Straits of Mackinac. And so that's unacceptable risk. I have taken a number of actions in Congress until we get to the point where we shut it down to make sure that we're dealing with it. But we also have to be dealing with pipelines all through the Great Lakes region. That Line 5 is a problem not just for the Straits of Mackinac. It runs the whole length of the UP, very sensitive ecological areas. A pipeline break there could also get into the Great Lakes. And so I was able to get two pieces of legislation passed last year. One will now categorize the entire Great Lakes Basin as a high-consequence area, which means it's subjected to the most vigorous federal oversight of any other pipeline. So the whole basin is now in that area. And I was also able to get language to require companies to, when they have a response plan, should there be a break, to consider ice cover. Surprisingly enough, that was never a requirement. And think of the Straits of Mackinac, difficult it would be.
Yeah.
So just think of the Straits of Mackinac, how difficult it is to clean it up already. The currents are strong. They go east. They go west. The amount of water that goes to the Straits is equal to 10 times that of Niagara Falls. And so now imagine a thick layer of ice over all of that. The Coast Guard, in hearings before my committee, basically in answer to a question of mine, said, no, we're not very comfortable. We could actually clean up a spill with thick ice. So now we'll require that. And that leads to the legislation that I just recently introduced with Senator Stabenow that now increases the liability for pipelines that are in the Great Lakes. Currently, Great Lakes pipelines and straits in the Straits, Line 5, is considered an onshore pipeline. So there's liability caps. The company doesn't have to pay for all of the cleanup, only up to the cap. But if you're an offshore pipeline, it's unlimited. You have to pay every single penny of cleanup. And so the bill we've introduced says that Great Lakes pipelines, particularly Line 5, is an offshore pipeline. And I challenge anybody, go stand on the banks of the Straits and look out. That's offshore. That's not an inshore pipeline that's going through that area. So you'll have unlimited liability. The company will also have to prove they actually have the resources to cover what would be an extremely expensive endeavor. And that also gives the Secretary of Transportation the power to shut down a pipeline if it is determined that they do not have the ability to conduct that cleanup, either financially or perhaps because of weather conditions. If there's ice cover and you can't clean up a disaster, at a minimum, you should not be operating that pipeline during the time there's ice cover.
Do you have votes for that?
Well, you know, the previous two that I mentioned, mm-hmm. the Great Lakes Basin as well as the ice cover, I received nearly unanimous support. So those were both put into law. So now I've introduced this legislation. And I have found that many of my colleagues on a bipartisan basis, but probably more important on this issue, sometimes these issues become regional when folks say, why do I worry about the Great Lakes? Because I live in Nebraska or Wyoming or wherever it may be. That people are coming to the realization that the Great Lakes are a national asset, not a regional asset.
Let's talk about what's going on in Washington. Robert Mueller, the special counsel, is looking into Russia's tampering with the elections last year. It's looking into criminal acts. The investigative committees in the House and Senate really have the job of going beyond just the criminal acts and finding out for the people, just what the heck happened and what's being done to make sure that it doesn't happen again. That's a tall order. How capable, how well-equipped is Congress to do that?
Well, I do have confidence that the Senate Intelligence Committee is working very diligently, has the ability to collect the information. We saw the hearing, the recent hearing. I think they did a very good job of questioning both Mr. Comey and other folks that they've had before the committee. My concern is an Intelligence Committee sometimes does things in a classified setting, and I do believe that we have to have full transparency. The American people need to know exactly what happened, what exactly are the facts. But they are going forward, and I support what they do. But I do think it is critical that we have this special prosecutor, special counsel now appointed. I was very pleased by that. I've been calling for that for a long time. And I believe that he needs to follow the facts to wherever those facts go. And hopefully we can get this done sooner rather than later.
What was your takeaway from former FBI Director James Comey's testimony yesterday?
Well, it's obviously a lot of what he testified about we already knew is in the paper. It confirmed that, though. I think he presented himself extremely well and as a very credible witness. But it was obviously very troubling to have the types of actions done by the president of the United States, statements that he made, the conduct that he was engaged in is unprofessional and may have crossed the line of obstruction of justice as well. So I don't think anyone could feel good about the president after hearing that testimony, and particularly hearing the director of the FBI basically saying he didn't trust the president and thought he would lie about whatever happened.
Those voters who solidly back President Trump believe this is a witch hunt, as he has called it. They just want the news media and Congress, people like you and me, to just help Trump, our president, get his work done. What do you tell people who let you know that that's what they want?
Well, certainly we have to get work done. I don't disagree with that. It's important for us to come together to find common ground. We have a number of incredibly serious and important issues that we have to deal with as a country. And the only way we can do that, I think, is coming together and try to find bipartisan solutions to these issues as well. But having said that, we've got some very serious concerns about what happened with the Russian involvement in the election. And no one questions the Russians were involved. In fact, I think Mr. Comey did a great job of really outlining how serious it is to have a foreign power engaged in the most fundamental aspect of our democracy, which is the election, that we have to get to the bottom of this. I think the Russians need to pay a lot larger price than they've paid. They need to know there are consequences for their activities. And if you have members of the Trump administration that were colluding, that is an incredibly serious charge, and it's a real cloud over the administration right now. And that's why I think having an independent investigation, this should not be partisan. This should just be about America. This is not about party. This is about our country. Having a special counsel and prosecutor who is looking into that is important. And as I mentioned, it has to happen quickly because there's no question this is a cloud getting in the way of the important business of the American people. But on the other hand, it is important in facts. Facts should drive the ultimate conclusion.
That is Gary Peters, U.S. Senator from Michigan. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Oh, always a pleasure. Thank you.
And that is our show for today. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.